This is the Lansing Fisher Body Historical Team. Today is Thursday, June 29th. It's approximately 10:20. We're at the Lansing Delta Plant Visitor Center. First, we're going to introduce the team.
Jerry Smith.
Marilyn Coulter.
Doreen Howard.
John Fiedewa.
Linda Johnson.
And I'm Cheryl McQuaid. Today we're interviewing Randy Thayer. Would you please state your name and spell it for us?
Randy Thayer, R-A-N-D-Y-T-H-A-Y-E-R.
And what is your address, sir?
Work or home?
Home.
Home, 10875 Riverside Drive, Diamonddale, Michigan, 48821.
And are you married? Do you have children?
Yep, married, 25 years, two grown daughters, 24 and 22.
And where were you born and raised?
Born in Lansing, Sparrow Hospital, be specific. Raised in Lansing, went to Lansing schools through 10th grade, and then went to Leslie my junior and senior year and graduated from Leslie High School.
Were you in the military?
No.
What did your parents do for a living?
My dad worked at Oldsmobile, and he was hourly, worked in Local 652, and he was a dynamometer operator in the engineering labs. And my mom was a nurse's aide at Ingham Medical, and actually she still is.
Wow.
She's retired, and they hired her back on contract, but she worked 55 years at Ingham Medical.
What did you do before hiring into GM?
Worked on my uncle's farm a lot through high school, which is how I ended up out at Leslie. Was my uncle had a corn picker accident when I was in high school. So I had to move out on the farm and help milk cows my last 2 years of high school. And I lived with my parents back in Lansing on the weekends, and that's how I ended up graduating from Leslie. We really didn't move. I still lived in Lansing. So that was my main high school job, was milking 70 Holsteins. Twice a day. Actually, once a day. My cousin do it in the morning. I'd go to school in the morning. I got on co-op, and then I'd milk at night. Plus, I put 1,000 acres of corn in my junior year, spring of my junior year. So I really haven't had any other jobs. I did work at a gas station for a while in high school, too. But.
And what did you do after high school?
Started working at GM. Actually, it was the day after graduation. And I was already accepted to go to GMI in Flint. So I was just, they let us start in the summer. And it wasn't really part of our co-op program yet. We were just working in the summer, and then I started school that fall in GMI.
So because you were going to GMI was why they allowed you to do the co-op?
Right, yep, yep.
Do you remember what it was like first walking into the plant for that co-op?
Yeah, it was a little scary. I mean, I was 17 years old, so, you know, there was very few people my age, but there were a few students around that summer, so it wasn't that bad. Actually, I wasn't that first summer. I wasn't out in the plant proper. I was in a warehouse over, it was called the old Duotherm warehouse, over in the corner of Mount Hope in Washington. Anybody remember where that was? And it was where we, Oldsmobile, used to keep all the service parts. And I was a shipping clerk for that summer.
And for those that don't know, what is GMI?
Well, that's not even the current name. Back then it was called GMI, General Motors Institute, and it was wholly owned by GM back then. And then in 84 it got put on its own, and its name now is called Kettering University, and it's a private engineering school in Flint. And I got my bachelor's in mechanical engineering there. Graduated in 78.
And were you given a job with GM graduation?
Yeah, worked in manufacturing engineering. It was my first job, mainly in the motor plants over at the main plant. And then I got put on the Plant 5 project and helped build Plant 5 and worked about a year on Plant 5. And then in 79, I got sent away to go get my master's on a GM fellowship. I went to Georgia Tech in Atlanta, went 5 terms, came back and worked the summer in between, worked in Building 90 that summer, and in material, and then went back, had 2 more terms, and I came back to work full-time again in March of 80. I got a master's in industrial engineering from Georgia Tech.
When did you come into Fisher Body?
It would have been 86. It was, of course, the reorg happened in 84, fall of 84, October of 84, I think. And maybe it had been 85. God, I had to check. I think it was 85 when I transferred from Building 90 to C-Trim. Rocky Wright and I switched jobs. We all remember Rocky.
Mm-hmm. We interviewed him.
Did you?
Yeah.
Good. It was back, when Shotters came in, the first thing he started doing was switching a lot of the managers because nobody had ever worked on the other side. And I was actually on vacation, came back from vacation. Rocky was sitting at my desk. I asked him what the hell he was doing there. And he said, "You don't work here anymore."
Marilyn Coulter.
Randy, for those people who don't understand, when you say the other side and stuff like that, can you kind of explain to
I was just
people?
Referring to before 84, Oldsmobile side ran the chassis operations and Fisher Body ran the body plant operations. So that was kind of the dividing line for management people. Nobody transferred back and forth because it was two separate divisions. So that all changed after the reorganization and a lot of people swap jobs in. So that's the first time I went on a superintendent of C-Trim for about 3 years. And that's when I first met Marilyn and Linda, probably. And then I transferred out of the plant but didn't leave town. They created a new planning group for the NCAR. And Terry Cox, who was the quality director at Car Assembly, got named the director of that group, and then Terry hired me to be the manufacturing planner for the division. And 6 months later, Terry got transferred to Detroit, and I got Terry's job. So that's the first time I made executive, was in that planning job. And then 6 months later, I got transferred to Detroit into engineering. I spent 3 years in product engineering. Well, it was product and manufacturing both. Working, I had the body, called Body and White Group, designed the body structure. And one of the projects we were working on at the time was the 92N. And when it got into production in fall of 91, Tom Police retired. And I got to come back home, and I was the assistant plant manager then, replaced Tom, and I was the assistant plant manager that time for 5 years. And if you remember, there was two of us, Gary Malkus and me, and Gary got put on working on the JCAR project, and I became the assistant plant manager for both lines. Up until then, each line had their own production manager, and then we went to area management, and I became the assistant, and Gary started working on the JCAR project. And then January of 96, I got transferred to Detroit again, and I was in North American Production Control Material Group, and that's actually when I got promoted to plant manager level. That job was a plant manager level. I had all the material stuff for North America. Spent 18 months in Detroit and got transferred to Atlanta. Spent 5 years at Doraville. Went down summer of 97 and came back January of 02 to Plant 3. And I was plant manager of Plant 3 for about 18 months until Delta started up. So that's the whole story.
I want to hear a little bit about being the superintendent of C-Trim. Do you have any favorite memories?
Yeah.
What was a typical day like?
There were a fair amount of transitions that happened with people who had traditionally worked with Local 652 and went over to 602. There were a fair amount of work rule differences that you had to get acclimated to. Actually, there was a guy, one of my assistant superintendents named Gary Hansen, though, who Gary worked at 652 first, and actually he transferred over a few months ahead of me. So Gary figured out a lot of the stuff to keep me out of trouble before I ever got there. But C-Trim was huge. I mean, it was a big department. I can't even remember, but it was probably 450, maybe 500 people. It was a big department. And the way it was back then, the day shift superintendent had control of the department in total, and then you had a night shift assistant. So you really had responsibilities for both shifts. But it was a big shop. I mean, it was a big department. There were lots of things to get accustomed to. If you remember back then, the local agreement was about this thick.
That's about an inch and a half, 2 inches.
Yeah, it was huge. I was trying to think who some of the folks that were on committee. Dan Smith was on.
Curly Jones.
Huh?
Curly Jones.
Curly was a shop. RT was one of my districts. I think who else was?
Jerry Taylor. For some time.
Jerry and C-Trim.
Yeah, because he was a repairman before he was in.
A guy by the name of Cy Meadows. Yeah. He was self-appointed superintendent of C-Trim. He ran me into the line. And Cy was... Actually, I think he probably classifies as a repair guy, but I'm not sure.
He was a repairman. Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of friends from those days that are still here.
Doreen Howard.
You've had the opportunity, unlike a lot of us, to go to a lot of different facilities. What differentiates the people from Fisher Body compared to the other workforces that you had the opportunity to work with? What made us different?
Well, really the only other workforce I can compare it to is Atlanta, to Doraville, because I don't really frankly see any differences between, you know, the folks that were at 652 and the folks that were at 602. The work ethic in Lansing was about the same on both sides, in my opinion. There were differences in how local agreements were administered, but there weren't a lot of differences in people's work ethics and people's backgrounds. And, you know, you'd meet somebody's brother on one side and somebody's sister on the other. So, I mean, other than the 1,000 feet it was, right, John? So, I can compare it to Atlanta. Although Atlanta went through some really serious turmoil, and that they'd had one shift for a number of years. When I went down there, we put the second shift on, and we proceeded to transfer in 2,300 people from GM plants around the country, over 100 different locals.
Wow.
It was a mess. And the base Atlanta Doraville folks had a pretty tight-knit culture, and they were a good workforce. But it all but got destroyed by all these factions coming in that were all fussing and fighting about whatever. By the time I left, it was starting to settle down, but it never really ever got back to what I was used to. And the funny part of the story is when I left the first time, I didn't want to leave. And Zupkus told me, "No, you got to leave." And I said, "I don't want to leave. I'd be happy. I was the assistant. I said, I'd be happy if I retired in this job." And he said, no, you got to leave. You don't know how good you got it. Because Zub had worked at a few other plants. And I said, "Well, I don't know about that, but I'd just soon not leave." And he said, "No, you need to leave." So, I mean, I was leaving on a promotion. I didn't even want to leave. So he was right. You know, I was used to working with friends and relatives and knowing lots and lots and lots of people. And I walked into just the opposite down there, you know, a plant where I basically knew two people in the whole plant. So, you know, it's a whole different feeling where you gotta start to, you know, figure out who's doing what and who can do what, and then, like I said, all the turmoil that was going on at the time. So, very, very, very different culturally and everything else. Because everybody used to say, "Well, what's so special about Lansing?" And I always used to, you know, think about, I'm not sure I can ever put my finger on it other than Lansing always had more than their share of people that have tried to come to work every day and make the place a little better. And I spent some time at Lordstown, too, though, back before I came back to Lansing in 92. I spent some time down there putting their body shop in, and that was probably more eye-opening than Doraville, that the culture there was very, very much people fighting and lots of strife, people not happy, people not communicating, probably a culture that, if I even go back to 73 when I hired in, I still couldn't recognize it, you know, as far as the amount of confrontation. So those are the two places that I got a reference point from.
Marilyn Coulter. Randy, I'm going to take you a little bit further back because you said you grew up in Lansing and your father worked at Oldsmobile. What was it like for you to grow up in a GM town, have a father that worked? Did you know anything about Fisher Body?
Oh, yeah.
And what was it like, and did you plan to work there?
Actually, sometime in high school, I knew I wanted to get into engineering and go to college. and my dad did go over to personnel and got all the stuff about GMI for me, so because he'd heard of it. My dad had a high school education, so he never went to college, but he knew what GMI was because he worked in the engineering lab, so he was working around engineers all day long. And so he got all the stuff for me, and then I applied and got in. But, yeah, I grew up in a very blue-collar family, and both parents had to work to make ends meet. And my brother ended up my brother and I, by the way, I have one brother. He's 4 years older than I am. We're very much opposites. We get along fine, but he's an artist. And he got his degree at Central, and then he got his master's degree from the Chicago Institute of Arts, and then he tried to teach for about a year and hated it. And I got him hired into Plant 3 in 78, running a press line, and he now works down at Milford and hope to get out in another 2 years. But he's always been that job was so he had money, and his real love is art. Actually, a fairly well-known artist around town. He does some fairly abstract stuff, but if you ever go to the jazz festival or the blues festival, he usually does the poster for especially the blues festival. He's done that the last 5 years, so the T-shirts and all that posters for my brother. So he's very much not an engineer. His brain is the other half, and I got the other half. He couldn't fix anything if it broke in front of him. And he can't. He can't. He's the artist. So, anyway, kind of uneventful family. Other than that, I mean, we're both always active in sports. Both him and I were. But as far as any other significant events, other than the one I told you about with my uncle losing his hand in a corn picker accident, was pretty stressful because I was going to school in Lansing and there wasn't anybody to help on the farm. My cousin was at Michigan State at the time, and so between him and I, like I say, I moved out there and got on co-op and went to school from 7 to 11 and then come home and milk.
Which high school did you go to?
Here? Mm-hmm. Everett.
Everett. Okay, so you didn't live near?
I lived on the south side. I went to North School until Atwood opened. I went to Atwood 5th and 6th grade, and then I went to West Junior in 7th and 8th grade, and then Gardner opened, and I went to Gardner in 9th grade, and then I went to Everett in 10th grade.
Okay. So you never were actually near the Fisher Body facility?
West Junior was pretty near.
Oh?
Yeah. You remember where West Junior was? Down at Kalamazoo and Lenawee?
Oh, yeah. Well, that was close to downtown.
If you remember back then, weren't you in town then?
I was very little.
Listen to her.
I was very little when that was there.
The integration busing that started to happen in Lansing started in the 60s. Actually, my brother was the very first integrated student at West Junior. They bused everybody south of Jolly Road to mm-hmm. West, and they bused everybody north of State Road on the north side, Valley Farms area, to West. And West was 75% black, 25% mm-hmm. white. And I got bused to West in 7th and 8th grade, but then they opened up Gardner and closed West up.
Mm-hmm.
And then they started busing just the opposite direction.
Mm-hmm.
And Gardner, though, was because there was a lot of Walter French people that milled in there. Gardner ended up, it was about 50-50. But when everybody was screaming about the buses being burnt in Pontiac, integration had been going on in Lansing for probably 7 or 8 years by then.
So when you talk about integration and things like that, being a plant manager and having it working in Fisher Body, do you feel like it always worked well at Fisher Body as far as people coming from outlying facilities, neighborhood areas, working in the plant?
I can't ever remember a racial issue that I ever encountered at the body plant. I can't. But I grew up in a very intermixed society here in town, and I still scratch my head here. I can't remember an issue that ever came up. The guys like Derek Quinney, mm-hmm. I used to run with. Derek was in my same class.
Oh, wow.
That okay. tell you something, huh?
Interesting class. But and that's one of the things, because people, for the most part, at Fisher Body always seem to get along. That's one of the reasons why the workforce is so well.
Yeah.
Linda Johnson.
Randy, your background, farming for your uncle, that took a lot of, that was very adult for you to do at that age. Did you have to give up your football playing?
No, I actually played football my junior year, and my senior year I didn't play, but not because of the work. It's because I thought the coach was very demeaning, and I didn't like the guy, and I wasn't going to play for him. I wrestled too my junior year, and I wrestled my senior year up until Christmas. And I loved the wrestling coach. Mm-hmm. I loved wrestling, actually, more than football. But I wrestled 155 my junior year up until Christmas, and then I got down to 145, believe it or not. And I actually had a very good—I was 32-8 my junior year, so I had a pretty good record. My senior year, I was starting out, same thing, 155 again, and I got to Christmas, and I just couldn't get down. And I was getting, I had like a 50-50 record, and I knew I was going to college that didn't have a wrestling team or anything. Mm-hmm. So I was just frankly tired of starving. Mm-hmm. And it was the first thing I'd ever quit in my life, was what I did. I quit at Christmas time of my senior year. I was just starving to death trying to get down to 145, which actually goes at Christmas. It went from 145 to 148, mm-hmm. but that still wasn't enough. So I, like I say, I was just tired of starving myself. And any of you ever had kids that were wrestlers, you know what I mean. It really is the most grueling sport there is. It's a team sport, but it's a very individual sport too. So,
Doreen Howard,
Randy, going back to some of your past experiences with all the hard work that you had to do as a kid, and how does that transfer your work ethic to today?
Yeah, well, I don't know. My work ethic, I think, was more from my dad than the farm. I mean, I worked hard on the farm, too, but I used to work out there every summer, even before that incident happened. But my dad, I don't ever remember him missing a day of work all the time I grew up. He just never missed a day of work, and he might take a week a year for vacation where we'd go somewhere, but he just never missed a day of work. And matter of fact, I can remember during the strike of, what was it, 69, 67? When was the big strike in town?
70, wasn't it?
70, 69, late 69, 70. I can remember my dad ended up getting a second job driving a pizza delivery truck, not delivering to houses, but he's working for Sir Pizza, delivering supplies to the stores. And he kept doing that even after the strike was over for a few months, trying to get some money put back in the bank. So, I mean, I'm just, and my mom always worked too. So, you know, I just, that's probably more where I got a work ethic than it was on the farm. But make no mistake, those 2 years in high school were a lot of work. I mean, I'd get up, go to school, come home, work in the fields all afternoon, milk at 4 o'clock, usually get back on the tractor, and in the spring anyway, plow and plant till the sun went down.
What was it like being raised by a man that worked at GM? Was life good? Was he home much?
Actually,
and what plant did he work in?
He worked for engineering in Building 66 at the main plant. Actually, he worked midnights almost all the time I was growing up, so it was like he didn't have a job. I knew he went to work every day, like I said before, but he worked midnight to 8. So in the morning when we were getting up to go to school, he was getting home from work. Usually see him, you know, passing in the morning. But then he'd sleep all day, and when we came home from school, he'd get up, and he'd spend all evening. I always remember he hardly ever missed a sporting event because he had his evenings. And then he'd usually, when we'd go to bed, he'd usually lay down for a half hour or an hour, take a little nap, and then he'd get up at 11 o'clock and go to work. So it was, like I say, almost like he didn't have a job.
That would must have been nice.
It is. Actually, midnights, if you can deal with the weekends, midnights was perfect shift to have family. But the weekends always tore him up because, mm-hmm. you know, he'd always try and switch back, get all screwed up. But, mm-hmm. but family-wise, it was fine.
Doreen Howard?
How do you deal with your personal life here with the amount of hours and the work that you do now?
Well, I put a lot of hours in, no question about that. But the kids are all gone, and I try and, when I'm out of here, try and relax. And at least so far, we haven't gotten into the weekends yet. I'm sure that's coming. But, back when the kids were little, it was actually tougher. 84, when we did the NCAR startup, was probably one of the worst startups we'd ever had. And I can remember, I think I worked 8 or 10 weeks in a row without a day off. I mean, it's just craziness that we're going through back then. But so I've done stretches like that through launch when I was younger. I don't think I could even do it now, but I'm generally 13 hours a day now. So it just, say when I get home during the week, plus I'm involved in a lot of other, unfortunately, when you get into busy times like this, a lot of the civic activity stuff that I have to do, and I don't have to, I want to do too, but it takes up time too. I think there was two nights this week. Last week was actually a good week, one night. The week before that was three nights, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday at something every night.
Could you elaborate on some of the activities
just board meetings. I'm on the United Way board. I'm on Highfields board. I'm on Peckham's board.
That was a good night, though.
Huh?
United Way was a good night.
When you did the van?
Huh?
When you did the van for the United Way?
That wasn't a night. That was during the day.
That was during the day. Night, we had a fun meeting.
Yeah, that was during the day. Chamber of Commerce, which generally isn't a lot of night events. Their meetings are generally during the day. Mm-hmm. And, of course, this spring, you know, being on Highfields' board, which generally would be 3 or 4 hours a month maybe, turned into February and March being about 20 or 30 hours a month, because mm-hmm. I am on the executive committee at Highfields too. So if you read, I don't know, get into that, but it was just a huge mess, and spent lots and lots of hours in meetings trying to figure out which direction we were going to go. So that was one that was completely unplanned. So anyway, you put it all together, and I try and enjoy my weekends is the bottom line.
Do you have personal hobbies?
Yeah, I've got a Harley that I love to ride. And I usually about half of my vacation time, I do bike trips without the wife. And the other half of the vacation time, Cindy and I do something together. We went to Hawaii on our 25th wedding anniversary in February for 10 days. Had a nice vacation there. I guess about 3 weeks ago, though, six guys went to Myrtle Beach on our Harleys. So I try and split the vacation time up. And Cindy takes vacations and goes and sees friends on her own, too. So got a cottage up north. Don't get up there enough, but that's where I'll go for the 2 weeks. And I've got an old 66 Toronado that I like to work on. I like to ski. I got a couple of snowmobiles, a couple of jet skis that are mainly for the kids. I don't ride them as much as I used to, but I do snowmobile, or try to. Last winter wasn't great for snowmobiling either. January, wasn't enough snow. In February, I got busy with the Highfield stuff. So, include pretty much all my hobbies.
What year was it that you were the assistant plant manager at Fisher?
92 through 96.
What was that like being the assistant plant manager? Were you on the second shift?
No, I was on days. It was, had all the production operations. It was like the old production manager job, except I had both lines. No, those were actually very, very good years. Both lines were running full. We were also working on bringing the J car in, and that's what Malkus was working on. Zupkus was great to work for. He let me run the production operation, and had good area managers back then. Ken Moore was here, Randy Waller was here, Tim Earle, and I'm trying to think, we had four area managers because we had one at Chassis. I was trying to think who was at Chassis at the time. I guess Ron Davis probably. Ron Davis was still here then. So, had good area managers. Actually, things ran quite well.
For being an old building, or what were some of the problems with having an old building to manage?
I don't know that there was any issues related to old building. We had our struggles with, paint. We always had to Band-Aid paint back together because paint needed to be replaced years ago, but... I can remember lots of breakdowns, but I can only remember one major incident when we got into craters that was very stressful. I mean, we went 2 weeks.
And craters is a paint?
Paint defect. Anybody else remember that?
Mm-hmm.
It was 2 days before Thanksgiving. Had to have been about 94. But in that afternoon, we had a... huge thunderstorm that rolled through town with about 50 mile an hour winds. It tore off about 30 feet of oven wall up on the roof.
Oh.
We had just changed clear coat formulations from DuPont. We had brought in a few new people into the paint shop, so we had all these variables that had changed. And we had an air, I forgot because it ended up being the actual cause, we had an air compressor go down in the powerhouse. And Dennis Doherty, who had replaced Leonard as the plant engineer, Dennis had brought in a rental air compressor. And all those things had changed, and within about 2 hours, we were completely shut down with paint defects. And we problem solved for, we didn't run for 2 days before Thanksgiving. We worked everybody all through Thanksgiving trying to figure out what it was that had gone on. And we had, I think it was Saturday, maybe Friday night of Thanksgiving weekend, we'd figured out it was in the air supply from the compressor. And we had to go get permits from the city to blow off the air supply. And the guys built a 6-inch stack to come off the back of the paint shop, the furthest away we could get from the powerhouse. A 6-inch stack, and we got a permit from the city to blow it off on Sunday. They wouldn't let us start before 10 o'clock. But at 10 o'clock, we cut this stack on, and you could hear it from probably St. John's. I mean, it was that loud. That was the only way. Everybody who was familiar with the problem said the only way you'll ever get whatever it is, it was silicon that was in the seals of the pump compressor. Wow. Got into all that black pipe in the paint shop. It was all black pipe. Old, black, rusty pipe for the airlines, and they said the only way you'll ever get it out is just do blow-offs. So they let us run it until 10 o'clock Sunday night, and Monday we tried to run again. It was a disaster, so we turned the blow-off back on again and blew it off for, another 2 days, maybe 3 days. And Thursday, I think it was, we tried again to run, and were able to salvage some jobs, and it was pretty stressful. I was getting a lot of help from downtown, from Detroit. we had a 120-an-hour plant shut down. It was, and as it turned out, as I mentioned, it was this compressor we'd rented that had silicon in the oil of the compressor, and it filled the whole paint shop air supply system with silicon. We put new filters in. We did everything. We changed every pipe in there.
It sounds like that was a really loud attack that had to go in. What about the neighbors?
That's why we had to go get the permit from the city. And, of course, we got some press about what was going on and why it was going on, but we didn't get any real negative reaction. They say we only ran it from 10 in the morning till 10 at night. But, all right.
Doreen Howard. A lot of the people, like myself, felt that the Fisher Body plant was their home away from home. It's very nostalgic to many people. What's your feelings toward the facility now that it's, you know, you worked there? How do you feel now that it's no longer there?
Well, I had an attachment to both sides of town, the Oldsmobile side too, and actually the building that I first worked in was tore down when Grand River was built. So I went through a little bit of that. I was actually living in Atlanta, but Kenny Moore was still here, and Ken went over and got me a brick when they tore down the old building 40 over there. So I've gone through this twice already. And the body plant, of course, had tons and tons of historical significance too. Of course, you know, being a Durant plant to begin with, and then being the body plant. But it's different though. If you've ever been at a place where they really announced it being closed, and I did leave that out. I did work out at Leeds after we closed it. I was trying to sell it to Isuzu. And just associating with the people that really didn't have a place to go, that's different than what we went through. Because I categorized the M System build-out that day as almost a celebration that we're ending one era and maybe starting another. And, you know, that's not your normal plant closing. People asked me then, isn't it really sad? Other people that weren't there. I said, actually, it wasn't very sad at all. I mean, it was some sadness around the memories of the, you know, but it wasn't sad in that.
It was bittersweet.
Yeah. It wasn't that, you know, we lost the plant. We were getting it replaced. So, you know, I've got lots of good memories from both places, but the closing and the last build out in the M System, you know, I didn't, you know, other than doing a little reminiscing, I didn't think it was all that sad of an event at all. Although Rosendahl brought foul flowers like it was a funeral, I don't know what he was thinking there. He drove up there and unloaded all his damn flowers. I thought, what the hell, Palmer Bush here?
Jerry Smith.
Yes, you were talking about the J car and the N car. For people that are not familiar with those, like a lot of us are, what exactly was the J car and what was the N car? The make of the car.
The N cars are what we switched to in 84. And it was the original Oldsmobile was called an Achieva. No, a Calais. The original was Calais. The second one was the Achieva. And we had a Buick Skylark. Actually, the original one was a Buick Somerset. And, of course, the Grand Am. Those were the three N cars. And then the J car was the Cavalier. And we also built the Sunfire, though, when we built convertibles. Mm-hmm. It was a J car. And then after that, the Malibu came in, which was also based off the N car. So it was classified as an N car.
Okay, thank you.
I was hoping you'd share another memory with us in the paint department, and that was you had a photographer up there that
set all the fires.
Yeah, could you tell us about that?
That happened more than once.
Did it?
Oh yeah, not by you. Oh. I think you only did it. You only did it once, but it happened more than once where somebody flashed and set all the fire. Deluge systems off, which dumps the water into the booth. But actually, the worst part of all those stories weren't those false alarms. We actually had four or five fires over a couple of year time in paint shop. We had some thinner fires and had a fire in the oven one time, I remember, that got going on a Sunday. I thought, this is not good. It was, I came in and they were having a heck of a time getting it out. They tore a lot of oven wall off. It's over on the far corner by the shipping building. Mm-hmm. And the city was in, and they were cutting ovens up like no tomorrow. So anyway, but the scary part of LCA's paint shop was we did have fires. And you know how buried it was back in there. If you really had something that got going, it wasn't any way you were going to get much equipment to it. So, but yes.
I remember when I worked up in 17-2, I was all by myself. And the guy that broke me in on the job said, if you see a lot of people from the paint department coming this way fast,
follow them.
Follow them. Don't ask any questions. Just get in the line. Go with them because it could be a fire.
Yep. Now, that was probably the scariest part, was the number of fires we had. But, yeah, we did also have a couple of flash deluges.
I didn't remember.
You actually were one of those.
Jim told me. I saw Jim right after that the next couple of days, and I saw him, and I thought he's going to say something. He says, well, Randy wanted to fire you, but I told him you didn't know what.
I can just hear him saying that, but I probably didn't. But, yeah, that happened at least twice, though. I know two different people that obviously neither one knew that if you were one, you know you didn't know what it would do. But. What else?
Explain it.
Explain what?
What happened?
Well, the fire detection system is always looking for spark, okay? And when you take a picture with a flash, you take pictures, but just not with a flash. So you took a picture with a flash, the fire detection system thought there was a fire. And it immediately opens up all the water that's called a deluge system that essentially floods the booth is what it does. It dumps so much water so fast that if you don't get out of there, you're going to swim out. That's so much water, and it brings all the filter tiles down at the same time, and it's about a six-hour cleanup.
Yeah, before skilled you can, trades guys told me I
you can run again.
Job protection.
Yeah. Yeah, it's ugly.
So that shuts the line right
there. We were down 5-6 hours. Yep.
So, Randy, that was an exciting moment for you. Were there any other, what you would consider really happy moments for you, or sad moments over at Lansing Fire Summit?
I don't know if there are any sad moments other than the normal breakdowns stuff. But no, those 5 years were good times. Zub was great to work for. I don't really recall any huge issues that ever went on that were, you know, scandalous or anything like that.
Just exciting, like with fires, right? So did you find that you found, because I know that you ride, and I know you ride with some of your coworkers, right? So were you able to develop some lasting friendships from the working at Lansing Fire Summit?
Oh, yeah. Of course, you know, Ken Moore and I, Ken went to Lansing schools, too. He went to West Junior also, so Ken Moore and I have been friends since sixth grade, and he was a year behind me at GMI, and then we ended up working together. Randy Walder was in my class at GMI, but I didn't know him before college, so Randy and I were friends in college, and then ended up, actually Randy Walder over my career has worked for me 3 different times, so yeah, but so, and I knew Tim pretty well, and I knew Ron pretty well. Actually, the first time I started working with the body plant was back, though, I was in a planning group early on before we ever got the NCAR project. And I was doing a planning job for Oldsmobile, and Herb Mattis was the planner at Fisher, and Chenoweth was the plant manager. And Herb and I put together the project to sell the conversion from rear-wheel drive to front-wheel drive for Lansing. And we worked on that together, and then when we went downtown for all the presentations, there was a Fisher Body presentation and there was an Oldsmobile presentation, because this was before 84, but that was my first real get-to-know of what all went on inside of the body plant. That would have had to have been 82 that I was doing that. So got to know Herb pretty well then, got to know Ron Davis pretty well, got to know Len Malin pretty well, Buckmaster, of course, Dick was there then, Chenoweth was the plant manager. I'll never forget, if you remember Chenoweth, you know, he was really into his arts and charts, and everything had to be, you know, 3-color and ribbons hanging, and he was into these fancy presentations. So Herb and I would show up down to the same meetings to do our 2.5, and I'd have black and white flimsies. Herb would get out movie cameras and all kinds of color photography stuff, and it was day and night. Seriously, as Chenoweth always was, you know, that. He was always into that kind of stuff. And so that was my first association, really, with the body plant. I forgot about that I, in the early planning days before we ever switched to NCAR, we worked on that together.
That was very significant for Lansing.
It was huge. Matter of fact, the rear-wheel drives were all going away, and everybody knew that. And the first project we worked on together, and I'm glad we didn't get it, was to do two F-car plants in Lansing to build Camaros and Firebirds. You remember back then, Van Nuys in California, mm-hmm. and Norwood, Ohio, built Camaros and Firebirds. There were two plants running F-cars. And they were getting ready to do the new Camaro Firebird. And we studied doing Camaro and Firebird in Lansing on both lines. Mm. And as it turned out, we were down, after that conversion, we were down to one plant on F-cars. And then St. Therese ended up being the last one, and then the car died. So we would not have, if we would have ended up getting assigned that project, we probably wouldn't all be sitting here today. Mm. We wouldn't have had near the last 20 years that we had. But luckily, that didn't go, and then we started working on the NCAR project to switch both plants to NCARs.
Randy, when you were working in the Fisher Body plant, was there anything about the plant or the employees that surprised you?
There was one thing, and that was the salary cafeteria, the executive cafeteria.
And tell us a little bit about that.
It existed, and on the Oldsmobile side, there was no such thing. Never was, that I know of anyway. Never was any time that I, in my career. So that was the first time, and actually I got exposed to it when I was working with Herb on that project and came over for a meeting. Herb says, come on, I'll buy you lunch, and we go in this private dining room, real china, real silverware, the whole thing. And I said, well, what's up with this? And he's, what do you mean? And he didn't know the opposite, okay? He didn't know any better the other direction. And I hadn't been to many other plants, but I did find out there was probably as many plants that still had those kinds of setups as didn't. Like Kalamazoo had one. But anyway, Oldsmobile side never had such a thing. I was kind of surprised. I thought it was actually, you know, wasn't good. I mean, and it wasn't very long after Shotters got here. It couldn't have been a month, I bet, and he closed it up. It was one of the first things Frank did. He just locked the door and said, that's gone. and it should have been gone a long time ago. It was just propagating a class system that just didn't have any, in my opinion, didn't have any usefulness at all. And matter of fact, didn't they used to have an executive cafeteria that certain levels could eat at, and then they had another one that seventh levels could eat at. Mm-hmm. And it just blew my mind.
And parking, too. They had their own parking.
Now, on the Oldsmobile side, there was a salary parking lot. Mm-hmm. I do remember that when I first hired in, but that had long gone, too, by this time. That was gone in the 70s. This was in the 80s yet.
Yeah, we still had a salary parking lot. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because I'd try to use my husband's parking pass to park there.
So that was probably the one surprise, the one biggest surprise. But, you know, right after Frank came to town, that was gone. So.
Now, was that also when the...
I probably only ate in it three times because it was gone by the time I worked at the body plant.
Now, there was a clothing transition that changed for supervisors, too.
Yeah, it was right? About the same time that the ties were going, you mean? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it was about the same time.
And the ties and the white shirts.
Yeah. I was trying to think when that happened, but it's about the same time.
I don't think that ever happened for Frank Mine.
It didn't. He wore he wore a tie the last day that he worked, which was just last year.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. He's the only one, though, that I know of that did.
Doreen Howard.
You talked a lot about the daily grind and a lot of the things that you did on a daily basis. Was there any pranks or jokes or anything that you did to kind of break the monotony of a routine day?
Well, this isn't about me.
I'll tell you one good story. It was funny. It was La Rosa's wedding, who now works here. And we were having the bachelor party over at, what was the name of the Mexican restaurant on Washington Avenue?
Ramon's.
And we were having the bachelor party upstairs at Ramon's. And we got over there, and nobody had a VCR player or a monitor, either one. And we had another guy brought some tapes. And I was trying to think who was with me. I can't remember who it was that went with me. But we went back to the trim shop. And at the beginning of the night shift, it was like probably 8 o'clock at night, and we carried the monitor and the VCR player out of the trim shop mezzanine office across the line, out through the garage, and took it over to Ramon's. I'm trying to think who the EPA was on nights. Daryl Spitz was on days. Whoever the EPA was
on nights. Marianne Carpenter.
She was upstairs.
Well, anyway, whoever the EPA was, I know, helped. And we hauled it over there and then hauled it back Saturday morning. But we got a lot of looks from people that watched us carry this TV set out of the plant for a bachelor party. Yeah. I don't know. There wasn't that many scandals that I know of or anything that went on. I can tell you the time I fired Rusty. You want to hear about that?
Rusty Ziegler? Oh, yeah. We want to hear that.
Rusty put on emblems. That was his job. Put on emblems. We'd go to audit day after day after day. And wrong emblems. You know, Skylarks on Somersets and Oldsmobile emblems on Buicks. And Bud McCurdy, I think, was the MC at the time. I know he was. McCurdy was the MC. And I said, Bud, you got to put somebody behind Rusty, and either he's got to put the right emblems on, and you know Rusty, he'd talk about something all day long, and I was convinced wasn't keeping his concentration on his work. So I said, put somebody behind him and convince him he's got to get the right emblems on the damn car. So what I didn't know at the time was he was being set up by another guy who I'm going to leave the name out. He was being set up. But Rusty ended up doing some time in the street all over wrong emblems, and there was another guy down the line who hated Rusty and was setting him up.
Oh.
Yep. And we finally got to the bottom of it. But in the meantime, of course, Rusty got some of that time was paid. And he came to the street. One of the nights after he was disciplined, somebody keyed a deck lid. I'll leave out what they wrote on the deck lid, but it wasn't very flattering to me. And they did it, trying to get everybody to think Rusty also did that on his way out, which he didn't. And that was probably a little exciting, trying to get that unraveled. And Rusty got caught in the middle of it. And he really was being set up by this other guy.
And it can happen.
Yep, it can happen. No question about it. So. What else?
Well, we'd like to thank you for sharing this time with us. And is there anything that you'd like to share with us that we've not asked you?
No, other than maybe a little bit on the new plant. I mean, I really probably got the best job in GM right now. You know, just not only being able to build a new plant, but to do it in my hometown. It's pretty special. And, you know, just the whole Lansing workforce makes it even more special. You know, I've gotten reacquainted with... When I first moved back to town, I was at Plant 3. I'd been away a little over 5 years, and, you know, it was tough getting names and faces back together, and you run into people in Myers, but, you know, just as everybody's now coming back to work, it's been really neat, just seeing it all come back together, and, you know, it's like we said during the first car announcement, though, it's like writing one more chapter, and, you know, our mission statement says it all, that, you know, we building on our heritage is what we're trying to do, and take it to the next level. So I got about the funnest job you could have right now.
Doreen, did you have a question?
I just wanted to kind of make a statement, I guess. We've always been known as the capital of quality, things like that. How do you see that statement? And how do you think that reflects on where we, like you said, building on our heritage, how they, from where we were to what the future will possibly bring for the area?
Well, we've always built high-quality vehicles. Now, the bar is raised over all these years. I mean, when we were building even the old rear-wheel drives back in the 80s, we were ranked in the plants. There weren't any outside rankings, so all we had were the internal GM rankings, but we were always in the top third of the plants, always. And so it's always been a quality-conscious group of folks here in town. And the NCAR did very, very well. And then the outside rankings came, the J.D. Power stuff, and we always did very, very well there. So the difference is the bar just with the outside competition just continued to raise to the point where, you know, quality is just the price of entry nowadays. I mean, if you've got something out there that has an issue, I mean, you're going to be found out real quick. So, you know, you got to be in the pack on quality, or you're just not going to last at all. So that part of the game has changed a lot. And customers used to tolerate a lot more than anybody will today, and it'll catch up with you real quick. But that hasn't ever been our problem. I mean, our problem's been trying to convince ourselves that we ought to improve when we're as good as we were, because you got to understand the rest of the world is improving too. It's like we say in GMS class, if you think you're good, just stop for a minute and people be going by you. You know, so that's probably always been our biggest challenge, is convincing ourselves. I still hear it today. People say, well, why do we want all these awards? You just told us we want all these awards. Why do we have to improve? We do. You got to stay ahead of the pack. Even if you think we're as good as we are, if you stop, even for a minute or a year, somebody's going to go by you.
Mm-hmm. There's always room for improvement.
Yep.
Absolutely. I mean, look at what the Koreans did in 5 years. Mm-hmm. They went from absolute crap. I mean, stuff there wasn't anybody in their right mind by. 5 years later, they're holding down lots and lots of the top J.D. Power spots on lots of cars. In 5 years, they made that big a move. Tough business we're in.
Yes.
And I just hope we can hang on to it. I'm not even talking about GM, I'm not even talking about Lansing, but I'm talking about as a country. We're definitely being threatened. We're the next industry that's being threatened seriously. Steel had to be
heavy
completely
industry.
Got reformed. TVs are gone. Apparel, clothing, all but gone. So it's pretty scary. Someday somebody's going to wake up and figure out we can't make a living flipping hamburgers for each other.
America has to realize that other people's ice is colder.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, we'll probably be the first generation that our kids don't live as well as us.
Mm-hmm.
My kids won't live as well as I do. I don't care how hard they work. And they both went to college. But they won't live as well as we do.
No.
And that's the first time. I mean, there was no doubt in my mind that I would live better than my dad. And I'm not talking about college or not college. I'm not even talking about any of that. I'm just talking about in general. When you look at, you know, availability of jobs, base level of the economy, you know.
Well, that's another thing. You talk about growing up in Lansing. And at one time, Lansing was like a hub.
Yep.
We hear the older people say that they could work at Fisher Body or Oldsmobile or Motor Wheel or Diamond Rio, Atlas, and now all those industries are gone now.
Right, exactly.
Because when we grew up, it was everywhere.
Yeah, and Lansing was actually very fortunate, because in Flint, that's all there was. In Lansing, we always had three legs of the stool. We had all the state of Michigan employees, and we had Michigan State and GM. So even in the years of the strike, which lasted, what, 90 days? I mean, it was pretty catastrophic for the area. The area didn't collapse because there was plenty of other people still working for the state government and for Michigan State. In Flint, that wasn't true. Flint collapsed during that time.
Mm-hmm.
Lots and lots of merchants went out of business, couldn't make payments. You know, they just folded up doors. They just collapsed because GM was all there was. Flint had 39,000 GM employees at one time.
Mm-hmm.
So. Okay.
Thank you for your time.
Just chatting with all of you.
All right.
Who's not back to work?